Hello,
You.
everyone. Let's give the date here, Martin Luther King Day. Many of you were home from work, some were not. January 15th.
I was
Okay.
not home from work. I would those of us in Canada were not home from work.
Okay. Well, a few things. One of you, I forget who, emailed me. I don't know if it was Nissen. I forget that Emanuel Jacobovitz's Shem Kodesh was Yisrael. That is true. And although by the time you get to the 20th century, many people in Germany had secular names, that is Goyishite names. Emanuel Jacobovitz, I've said it before, I'll say it again, he's named after Immanuel Kant. So it just shows you how assimilated even the Orthodox were. Pinchas Bieberfeld's an important German Orthodox family. Pinchas Bieberfeld's father, Eduard Bieberfeld, rabbi, he was a doctor, he was a rabbi, and in his 30s, I believe late 30s, decided to become a doctor. I mean, real Torim Derech Eretz. He wrote a book, his Hebrew name is Chaim, wrote a book on Hilchos Shabbos, which used to be widely used. His son, he named his son's Hebrew name is Pinchas, but the name his son went with everyone was Paul Bieberfeld. Paul was named after Hindenburg. After a victory in World War I, the son was born, and they named him Paul after Paul von Hindenburg. So very strange with the German Orthodox. Okay. One of you asked a very good question. I didn't think we'd be talking any more about Aninus or anything like that, but if you recall, so I'll throw in one more thing. If you recall, I raised a question. It's in Greenwald's book. You get a telegram and, the funeral's tomorrow. So are you an Onan? Are you not an Onan? Machlokes, the Netziv and his son-in-law, Rav Rafal, Shapiro and the Marsha. So the question is, it's a very good question. Do you even have to tell someone? I mean, today, obviously today we're on the phone. Today, during COVID, we went back to the way it used to be. Because now, of course, my grandson has a bris in California. I'm on the plane and I'm going there. I'm on the plane to go to the funeral. But it used to be that no one did things like that. And it wasn't that long ago people didn't do things like that either. I mean, it used to be you would get a letter months later that someone died or there was a bris. And that's the whole sugya in Avelos called Shmur Rechoka. What type of Avelos? Maybe you do one day. Depends on when you get it. But the question is, do you need to tell anyone anything? Do you need to inform someone if someone died? Today, it's unheard of because we're in constant communication. But what's the halacha, though? So let me show you something here, which I think will surprise people. You might even think it's unfair. It's not right. It's that. But what can I tell you? So here's the Shulchan Aruch 402, Tuf Beis. Number Yud Beis, one well, in Hebrew it says Misha Meisla Meis. If someone dies, Velo Nodalo, and you don't know about it, Eino Chovan Shiomruah. There's no obligation to tell someone this. Not only is there no obligation, the practice was in many places you don't tell someone. So in other words, if someone died in one city and then in another country or faraway place. The people who would have to say shiva were, you wouldn't send a letter there. You wouldn't inform them. And what does the Shulchan Aruch say? Va'afilu ba'aviv ve'imo. You don't even tell that about if it's their parents. And the Shulchan Aruch goes on and says that you can invite them to a wedding. You know about it, but they don't know about it. So you can invite them to a wedding. All these things that they couldn't do if they're an avel. Now, what does the Rama say? Umikoma kom bevanim zacharim nagu hodiah. Kadeshiomer Kaddish of Ababonos Ainmina Kalodian. So the Rama, citing Mari Vile, tells us that the Minhag, not Halacha, the Minhag is you tell sons, because the sons have to say Kaddish. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't say that. Shulchan Aruch apparently isn't so Kaddish Yosom, really begins in the Ashkenazic world. So you see that the Shulchan Aruch doesn't think it's such a big deal. And the Rama says only the sons you tell. That's the minhag, but daughters you don't tell. So And you never would tell a parent if the child died. I mean, today, how do you, I mean, we're in telephone communication, but if you know the son goes to America and the mother is back in Russia, the son dies, you don't say it to, maybe you can send some fake letters, whatever you do. We know that was the minhag, that people would not inform it. It's obviously it's impractical today unless you're dealing with a very, very old person who sort of is in and out. And if you don't tell them about the child died, they won't realize it. But this is a sort of practice that today no one would ever do. So it's a very good question, but I don't think it's relevant today because today I think it's unheard of not to do this. And since we're in constant communication with people, you couldn't get it, you couldn't hide it. The whole idea was that you can get away with it. You can't get away with it today. But I want to tell you something funny about this, or not funny. Rabbi Charles Salanter had a son, one son, no, two sons, he had two sons. But he had a son, a brilliant son named Yitzchak Lipkin. He was a complete Shomer Shabbos, but he also became more enlightened, let's say. He went to the university, even had an invention. And he was treated with great respect, even by the non-Jewish. He died, unfortunately, early at age 30, from I don't know. It's some sort of the English translation is chicken pox, but I don't know. I don't know if exactly that's what it was. So he, incidentally, the Rabbi Saul Salanter spoke about that it's important to learn Russian and to become well versed in the world. So when his son did that exact thing, the Maskilim seized on it and he made a big deal about it and he even published when once he came to visit his father in Königsberg, and the Maskilim put out a whole thing saying that the great Isaac Lipkin's here, who makes his father so proud because he's learned in secular matters, and Rousseau Salanter published an open letter saying he's not proud of his son, and if anyone has influence on him, you should influence him to return to the way of Torah. So when Rousseau Salanter spoke about broadening oneself, he didn't mean his own child. He wanted to, and in general, he did for Russian Jews. What he meant was to know some Russian. He didn't mean Torah and Derech Eretz like in Germany, which he supported for German Jews. Okay, so why do I mention this? Because Rousseau Salanter's son, he died, and he was living in St. Petersburg, and Rousseau Salanter had his student was the Rav there, Yitzhak Blazer, and he told him that he has to watch out for my son, and it's because of Yitzhak Blazer and others that the son remained religious his whole life. And Rav Yisrael Salanter wrote to you can see in the book Tnuas HaMusar, volume 1, page 229, that he writes to Rav Yitzhak Blazer, and he asks him, you know, what's doing with my son? I mean, it's like Blazer replies, it's 3 months now that he hasn't eaten paspalter, that is non-Jewish bread. So what does that mean? There was the only bread in St. Petersburg was non-Jewish bread. That is from non-Jewish bakeries. They didn't have a kosher bakery. You can eat, you're allowed to eat non-kosher, not non-kosher, you're allowed to eat bread from a non-Jewish bakery as long as it's kosher. The pasakum, we assume, I mean, there's a chumrah during the Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, but in general, that's halacha. You can eat from, there's no bishalakum or anything like that. But so there only was regular bread there. So that was Yitzhak Blazer. He couldn't lie to his Rebbe, but he didn't want to tell him he passed away. So he said to him, he hasn't eaten paspalter for the last 3 months. And Yitzhak Salanter got the point. That's the story that's recorded, that he no longer was living. In those days, you had the Pale of Settlement. So only special Jews could live in St. Petersburg, or even to visit, you had to have a special permission from the government. My step grandfather was a chazan with his father, and they got permission to come Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, go to Moscow to be a chazan. But the typical Jew couldn't. Two more things. I'm going to get to Yadid Nefesh too, but not this class. I've been waiting a few weeks already. If you recall, I read the Maharam Shik's Tshuva to Rav Bamberger, and he says, he doesn't know, how can you get reformers? The reformers, Mechalel Shabbos, which means they're like Ovdei Avodah Zarah. So I just want to call your attention to something that I just picked up, and Here's the book. Oh, I gotta share. Let me stop sharing the screen here. Here's the book. Warmth and Radiance of Gedolia Searle. I like books like this. Personal Accounts, Encounters, and Experiences by Rabbi Avishai David. He was in Toronto, I gather from the books. I had some stories there. But on page 80, it's actually a chapter on Rav Yerucham Gorelick. I never knew Rav Yerucham Gorelick, but everyone describes him the same way as like this explosive personality together with great chesed. You know, it's a strange combination. But he writes that on page 80, he says that, see, what happens is the Mishnah Brura says as follows. Let me show you something. The Shulchan Aruch says in Hilchos Kapayim in 128, Mumar Lakum, an apostate who converted to idol worship may not perform the blessing. Okay, so an apostate can't, someone who worships idols can't do Nisias Kapayim. So what does the Mishnah Brura say on this? He says, Mumar, Ben Vodazara, Ben Beshoge, Ben Mezid, either intentionally or unintentionally, even if he did tshuva. And then he goes on, even if he converted to Das HaYishmaelim, that is, even if he converted to Islam, She'enon Ovdim Avodazara, Muslims, those who listen to our, on December 25th, the Torah in Motion, a wonderful, wonderful day. If you haven't heard it, really great. So I spoke briefer than I usually do. I couldn't elaborate, as is my wont. But we spoke about how Islam is not Avodah Zarah. So, but the Ramos quotes the Achronim that if you convert to Islam, and then of course you come back to Judaism, well, no, it doesn't mean you didn't. No, you didn't come back. I mean, if you already you converted and you still want to do it, I'm sorry. You're still a mumar, even though there's no Avodah Zarah. And then look at the Mishnah Berurah says, the Mishnah Berurah says, halacha, he doesn't know about the Binyan Sion or anything like that, that if you're a Mechal Shabbos, you can't, he's like an idol worshiper, you can't do the Siyas Kapayim, you can't do it. So he quotes here in 80 that the Rav Soloveitchik said that his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, did not agree with the Mishnah Berurah, who said that a mumar achal Shabbos is akin to one who worships idolatry. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik drew a sharp distinction between an idolater and a mechal Shabbos befar Hesia. Look, we don't follow the Mishnah Berurah anyway. I don't know if anyone does, even in the Haredi world, because we've generally accepted the Binyan Sion, the great German posek, Yaakov Ettlinger, that today's Mechallel Shabbos are not, they're not really rejecting, they don't know any better, or it's a Yavon. You know, the Chazon Ish basically holds the same thing. But I thought that's interesting. Okay, the last thing I want to do briefly here is the name. We spoke, we got into the names, and one of you said, and, you said about the name Yisachar, that it's the only, maybe I misunderstood. It seemed to be, you said that it's the only time two sins are together. And, as was pointed out by, Ezra, it's not true. I mean, you have in Tehillim, this pasuk, Kuf Samach, what is this? It's a very long chapter of Tehillim. Hold on, 119, Kuf Samach, Pasuk Kuf Samach Aleph, it says, Sasa nochi elim, rejoice at thy word. And I looked up today in the concordance, and there's many examples of where of sason and some other things. So of Vesasti. So please clarify whoever said that. But in the meantime, I want to pull your attention to a couple of things. How should it be recited? Because a couple of people asked me about. Now, Nissan said about the Mincha Shai and what you were told by Rav Tuvia Goldstein. Rav Tuvia Goldstein was reflecting an old practice. The Jordan Penkower, Yitzhak Penkower, has an article in which he, the same article of his, which he discusses how to pronounce Zecher, Zecher, Zecher. He also discusses Yisachar. A few hundred years ago, the practice began, different practices, how to pronounce it, when to recite it. That is, that sometimes you say Yisachar, other times you say Yisachar. But Nissan, you said the Mincha Shai. The Mincha Shai doesn't say it. The Mincha Shai says everywhere you read it as Yisachar. I'm looking at the Mincha Shai right now. And the truth is that everyone, the Masorah is, you have to pronounce Yisachar. This other practice, where sometimes you say Yisachar, others not, That's a few hundred years ago. None of the Rishonim, in fact, the Midrashai says explicitly that it's all, he cites the Rambam, Rabbi Avraham, Ibn Ezra, the Radak. Now, what about Ben Asher and Ben Naphtali? Some of you might know that this is a matter of dispute between Ben Asher and Ben Naphtali, but it actually isn't. Ben Asher says you pronounce it Issachar, and the second sin is not mentioned. Why it didn't fall apart away, I don't know, because it's a negation of the first sin, but you don't. What did Ben Naphtali say? There's actually two versions of Ben Naphtali. One says, and I'm looking at it right now from the Chiyuvim, one says you pronounce it Yis-Sachar, that is Yud-Sin, and then you say Sachar, Yis-Sachar. Now, this is not in accordance with David Kimchi's rules. David Kimchi's rules are, whenever you have two letters that are the same, you can't have a shvanach. So we would say, we don't say hin ni, we say hin ni. But normally, of course, at the end of a syllable, it's a silent shva, and in the beginning of the next syllable is a vocal shva. So yish meru. However, the rule of the Kimchis is it's when it's the same vowel, same letter, then it you the first one becomes shvana, so it's inani. But that was not shared by the people before the Kimchis. It seems to be a novelty of the Kimchis. And one approach is that it's yis, that's a shva under the sin, sachar. So yis sachar. And the other version of Ben Naphtali is that the first letter is a shin. So it's actually pronounced yish sachar. And Penkower thinks that's the correct version because it would be like yesh sachar. That's what it's from. So we have two versions of Ben Naphtali, but there's no version that says, I shouldn't say that. There's no version of Ben Naphtali that says yisachar. What we do have, we have something called Likutei Kadmonios, which is recording it, but that's not, he records Ben Naphtali as saying that. Take that back. But that's not in the Chiluvim, and it's not in the Tshuva of HaGaon. But really, according to the Masorah, it should always be Yisachar. And that's all I want to say about that. And I'll get to Yedid Nefesh next time. What I want to do about Yedid Nefesh, I'll mention it now, anticipate, because some of you might want to send me things. How is it that Yedid Nefesh, one of you said, is it true? We spoke about Yedid Nefesh weeks ago when I was wondering where this practice came from, that we say it out loud. And I think we determined, I think Nikki said it comes from Kibbutz Avi. But someone asks, do we have another case where we sing something and we're singing the wrong version and we all know it's the wrong version because we have the actual handwritten text of the Mechaber? And a good thing you don't use the Koran Siddur, because at least the Koran Siddur I have only has the version you're not supposed to say, because it doesn't fit with those tunes we do. But I want to show you some interesting things about Yedid Nefesh you probably don't know. Okay, my friends. We are now picking up. I think I have two more classes or class and a half still dealing with the separatism dispute. And then before we return back to Rabbi Bamberger, we finished with Germany. We finished with Hungary, and I want to move us into America a bit. And this is going to, it'll be repetition for some of you who've been with me, but there'll be some new things, and I can't not do it. I can't say we'll go back to the classes of the Rav a few weeks ago, so we'll do it, although quickly. I do want to, though, one more thing about Hungary and the great book I love, I mentioned before, by Rabbi Pinchas Miller called Olamo Shel Abba, which is it's his father's recollections of Hungary. He says that on page 461, he says that although the Haredim knew that you could not go into a Reform synagogue and use their shechita, but on other matters such as tzedakah, gemilus chasadim, chevra kedisha, the cemetery, he said that the Orthodox and the Reform did cooperate. So that's not as extreme as the Hirschian community. He says something interesting as well. He says that you can't say that the issue is to cooperate with non-Orthodox. That is, non-Orthodox as individuals. And I think Hirsch agrees with this. The issue is the community's reform, but he gives a good proof. Remember, they had the dispute in Hungary, the Teilung, The Orthodox and the Reform, they're all called together by the government, and the Reform refuse to accept being bound by the Shulchan Aruch, by Halacha, and therefore the Orthodox have to split. If the Reform communities would have agreed, that is, the Reform leaders would have agreed that as far as the communities are concerned, publicly, we'll follow the Shulchan Aruch, then there never would have been a split in Hungary. So that shows you there's no issue with the non-Orthodox. It's only in an institutional way. But Hirsch would say the same thing. If the non-observant in Germany would have agreed that all the public institutions and all the synagogues would be Orthodox, then non-Orthodox could also remain a member of Hirsch's shul. That's okay. They couldn't be a member of the board, but they could be in it. And you had in Hungary, you had members of Orthodox synagogues who were not Shomer Shabbos. Remember, the issue was who's going to run the community. And then State of Israel, it's the same thing. You have plenty of non-religious, but the community structure remains a Torah structure. And that's the case. That's why in Poland and Lithuania it was so different. Because even though you had Maskilim and you had Bundists and you had communists and you had atheists and all that, and they also were running communities, they never tried to create reform institutions or heretical institutions. They were happy to remain, to allow the rabbi to be an Orthodox rabbi. Sometimes they wanted a Zionist, but the rabbi was always an Orthodox rabbi. And there's always kashrus. That's different, of course, than what was going on in Hungary and in Germany, where the non-Orthodox wanted to change the institutions. So many people have said that that's why you can't, there's a difference between what's going on in Lithuania and Poland. Because yes, you had one board of a community and you had heretics sitting with the rabbis and all that. But the difference is this isn't like Germany, because the heretics in Warsaw, they were not interested in getting a reform rabbi, and they were not interested in creating a reform Beit Din and having non-kosher in the old age home. In other words, they didn't care about these matters to begin with because they were like secular. They were not attached to religion. So that is an important difference between, and that is why things were so different in Lithuania and Poland, and maybe why you can't extrapolate. We'll return to this because this issue is important. The people in opposition to Hirsch like to point to Germany and like to point to Poland and Lithuania. Okay, but well, let's go further because look, Auschwitz begins in Germany and Hungary. But after World War II, it reaches America. Now, we're not speaking, like I said last class, about technical Auschwitz. There's no technical Auschwitz. We don't have kahilas. They wanted to establish kahila. This was a big plan early, but even then in America in the early 20th century, it would have been like a voluntary kahila that we all donate to. I mean, if you listen to Rabbi Jeremy Weider, he has this, him and Rabbi Kelman have solutions to the tuition crisis. But Rabbi Kelman's makes more sense, I think, because Rabbi Weider's solution assumes that everyone's going to will have one community and we'll all send to the same school. But that's impossible because no one's going to send to the same school. Different people want different schools. The Haredi are not going to send to the same school that the modern are going to. It's just a different. So I don't see how it's workable. But so at the most, you could have a voluntary kahila where we all agree to, let's say, contribute, and then we'd all support the school. But there's no such thing as the government forcing us to be in a kahila, so you don't have technical Auschwitz, but you do have an Auschwitz philosophy that to separate from the non-Orthodox as much as you can. Now, Auschwitz, I don't want to talk about Israel. Because I've already spoken about it. I will speak next class or maybe today, but probably next class about Rav Kook, because Rav Kook, he's worth just devoting some time to because he sees Rabbi Bamberger falsely, but he sees Rabbi Bamberger as like his model. So we'll return to, before we then segue back into Rav Bamberger's life, it's worth seeing what Rav Kook does with Rav Bamberger. But I'll just say that in Israel, we could have many classes just on this. It never made sense. It would be counterproductive because all the monies come from the government. So how can you not be part of the larger community? But the Agudas Yisrael, the original approach of Agudas Yisrael was a complete separatism, not to be part of the Vat HaLaomi. And then after the state was declared, they would say, not to be not to be part of the state, but the Aguda rejects this. By the 1940s, they see that this is not going to get them anywhere. And the Jews coming from Poland and Lithuania, Even the Jews from Germany, they no longer saw this as something valuable. And the Jews coming from Poland, Lithuania, they always joined the general community. It was called the Vat HaLumi. But the ironic thing is that the German Agudistan, when they went to Eretz Yisrael, they identify with the Eda Charedit. Yaakov Katz talks about how he was married in Israel by Rabbi Zonenfeld, Rabbi Dushinsky, Rabbi Zonenfeld, Rabbi Dushinsky, I'm sorry. There was no connection between them. The Torah and Derech Eretz Jews, what's their connection to these extremists in Israel? And of course, it fell apart. But that's a different topic in and of itself. The only thing I would note here is that someone's going to have to write a history of Agudas Yisrael one day, an honest history, because Agudas Yisrael was formally attached to the Eda Charedit for all those years in the 30s and into the early 40s. And therefore, Agudas Yisrael has to take some of the responsibility. Now, what I'm going to say now has nothing to do with Agudas Yisrael in Poland, in Lithuania, in Germany, who are dignified people who respected Rav Kook and others. But the Agudas Yisrael in which was the Eda Charedit, Neturei Karta was Aguda. They were all in the same thing. They engage in not just character assassination, but the worst kind of abuse and libel and disgusting behavior imaginable in the land of Israel. So much so that in the 50s, when Tzvi Kook was invited to become part of Agudas Yisrael, he said, "How could I join an organization that he said that brought my father to an early death?" Now, Agudas Yisrael needs to take responsibility for this because they never. They privately protested, but they never threw them out because they needed them. And the Gedolim, who were in the Eda Charedit, were either afraid of these people or whatever. I don't know. It needs investigation. But the most Agudas Yisrael's umbrella was over the most disgusting anti-Torah behavior, and the Gedolim in Europe themselves were fed up with this. When the Ger Rebbe, who was a leader of the Agudistan, came to Eretz Yisrael, the local Agudistan treated him with the worst things imaginable, the way they treated him. And so basically, functionally, they were two separate Agudas Yisraels, but they were connected. And that's an issue that if they ever let you into the Aguda archives, you could see what Rosenheim was trying to do, what Breuer was trying to do, and what the Ger Rebbe were trying to do. But they couldn't control the fanatics, the madmen in Israel, and the crazies that you see today in Israel. They are direct descendants of these people. Okay, I want to though speak about the ideology of Auschwitz in America. Now, before World War II in America, you had two types of rabbis, Orthodox rabbis. You had old-fashioned rabbis, the ones who came from Europe, who spoke Yiddish, who were strong in those days because you still had a large Yiddish-speaking population. And then you had the more modern rabbis educated by Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Hanan. And this was a battle between the two rabbis, and communities could choose, and communities that were run by old-timers would like these old rabbis. And by the way, there were big Talmid Chachamim in all these little places. I mean, up in Portland, Maine, and in Omaha, Nebraska, and all little towns everywhere you go, you had big rabbanim who wrote Sfarim and Talmid Chachamim. The old-fashioned rabbis, as the young generation arises, they were being pushed out in favor of the younger rabbis, and they never really integrated on the scene. American scene, they didn't speak English. They didn't have really any sort of organized cooperation with the non-Orthodox. They were hired. They had a little shul. They did some hashgacha. They did weddings, and that was that. If a politician was coming to town, all the rabbis would get together to greet the politician, the Reform rabbi, the Orthodox rabbi. I was zoche to learn one summer with Rabbi Soloveitchik. The last summer he had the summer kollel. And I was also zoche that I was with Rabbi Chaim Jachter. Chaim Jachter had a car, although I think maybe one day I had the car, because I also had a car. And we drove Rabbi Soloveitchik back and forth. So here you had from the Torsky. So here you had like 10 minutes to speak to him. So I asked him all sorts of questions. And one of the things I told him was, I don't know how we got into the conversation, but I said to him that this, I was there the summer of 85. So this, what I'm going to tell you about happened in the summer of 84. I said, I don't remember how we got into the conversation, but I told him, I asked him, do you know Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld? I mean, it's a stupid question. Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, as I know now, but I was 18 years old then, or 19, 18. I was going to be 19 in August. Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld was one of the closest students of Rabbi Soloveitchik, colleague students of Rabbi Soloveitchik. So the idea, but I didn't know that. This is the brother-in-law of Rabbi Emanuel Jacobovitz. So I said to him that, Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld gave the address at the Republican National Convention, the prayer. When Mayor Soloveitchik did it in 2012, a lot of people were saying it's the first time the rabbi ever did it. It's not true. I remember Fabian Schoenfeld, and I found you can hear it on YouTube, his prayer to the Republican National Convention. So I said this to Rabbi Soloveitchik. Well, I wish I remember what we were talking about when we said it. And Rav Soloveitchik got all, he didn't, he clearly didn't know about this. In those days, he wasn't all there, Rav Soloveitchik. It was the end. He did not know about this. Or he knew and he forgot, whatever it was. He didn't know. He got very excited and he wanted to hear about it. And then he said to me, me and Rabbi Jachter, he said that when he first, he said how important this is because when he first came to America, he was in Boston. He said, whenever a politician would come to town, the Orthodox who couldn't speak English, they would, when they had this delegation, I'll meet the politician, the Reform rabbi would have to speak for the Jewish community. And so Soloveitchik thought how amazing this was that now you could have an Orthodox rabbi be chosen to, give a talk like this. There were some, if I want to be honest, I have to say that there were some old-fashioned Orthodox rabbis who were involved, who had, I guess, mastered English, and who were involved not just with the general community, but with the non-Orthodox rabbis and community as well. So one name that's has I've heard mentioned, I haven't seen this in print, but Rabbi Kefet has mentioned this, is Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Rief. As you could tell, he's an Anakol, he's a great grandson of the Netziv. He was the Rav of Camden, New Jersey. Now, Camden, New Jersey, for a while in the, I think it was the 1990s, Camden, New Jersey was the murder capital of America. It's since been overtaken by other places. But Camden, New Jersey had an Orthodox rabbi of significance, an old-fashioned, and he was, on like a board together with the non-Orthodox rabbis. I know that the rabbi of Scranton, a Sobotka Musmach, a rabbi there for like 40 some years, Rabbi Gutterman, Zvi Gutterman, his shem chol was Henry Gutterman, but Zvi Gutterman, he would even come to Yeshivas Ribitzo Chonon to do the bechinas, an old-fashioned Talmud Chacham. He was involved with the Federation of Rabbinic. They made like a rabbinic board or something, or whatever, whether it's an official rabbinic board or he was involved with the non-Orthodox rabbis in town for matters of Jewish concern. His federation would have something, so he'd be involved with it as well. I asked Rabbi Fine from Scranton about this. Obviously, the rabbis today would never do anything like that. And he said, and maybe he's right. He said that Rabbi Guterman had to do that because in those days, the Orthodox were weak. And if they wanted to have any, if they wanted the Federation to look out for them, to do things, if they wanted to protect their interests, they had to be involved with the entire community, including the non-Orthodox, because otherwise the Orthodox would be overlooked. It could be right. I mean, I don't know. Maybe Rabbi Guterman had more of a Klal Yisrael, Matei Levi. We spoke about Matei Levi in a Harvard sense, that he should be involved with everyone, including the non-Orthodox rabbis, or maybe not. I don't know. But it was mostly the American-born graduates, not just of Ritz Hanan, but the other yeshivas as well, who were on the interdenominational boards, the rabbinic boards, the interdenominational boards with federation, and their synagogues were members of the various local synagogue councils, and eventually you had something called the Synagogue Council of America, which had Orthodox, conservative, Reform synagogues. I don't know if it ever had Reconstruction, as it closes in 94, but the Orthodox Union was a member of that. And this made perfect sense in that era. No one, so to my knowledge, no one thought it was problematic, no one of any stature, that is. I'm unaware before World War II of any attacks on this, even by the East European type of rabbis. You almost get the sense that this wasn't their thing, but it's not their communities. I mean, if you have a shtiebel in Brownsville, There's no interdenominational because that just doesn't exist. But if you're, in Seattle or something, then it's a different situation. And the idea that these Orthodox rabbis were somehow legitimizing the non-Orthodox by being together on a rabbinic board, or, a federation creates a board of the rabbis, and all the rabbis come together to speak about how best they can make sure matzah is brought to town, or, they're going to meet with the politician, all that. No one thought that this is giving the non-Orthodox rabbi legitimacy. What's the legitimacy? The non-Orthodox rabbi, he has a shul of 200 families. I'm the Orthodox rabbi. I have 150 families. We want to make an impact, so we're going to come together. It has nothing to do with me saying that his shul is a halachic shul, or this rabbi is a halachic rabbi. Yeah, that's what people thought. And when World War II arrived, there was a need to put out religious literature and give rulings for the soldiers. And the rabbis of all three denominations came together. They put out a siddur, they put out other literature. And again, this was not thought to be giving legitimacy. It was thought that everyone understood there's Orthodox rabbis, and then there's non-Orthodox rabbis, and the Orthodox rabbis don't agree with the non-Orthodox rabbis, but there's issues of larger concern that sometimes it's necessary to come together. This approach continues after World War II, and the 1950s, I think it's fair to say, are really the heyday of what we can call liberal modern orthodoxy. And there's some really important modern orthodox rabbis who continue this model. Emanuel Rachman, Joseph Hochstein, even Leo Jung, who comes from German Orthodox background. They were at the forefront of involvement with for the larger good of Kol Yisrael. Now, everything changes in 1956. And if you believe the story that's told, I don't believe it. But if you believe it, here's the story. And I'll tell you why I don't believe it. The story goes as follows. According to the story, Mordechai Feuerstein, who was one of the leaders of the OU, I don't know, in 46, 56, he might have even been the president. He's an important leader of the American Orthodox community, and before Orthodoxy was fashionable. Very close to Rav Soloveitchik, although when Rav Soloveitchik first comes to America, and Mo Feuerstein is a student at Yeshiva College, he actually is in the opposition to Rav Soloveitchik. We spoke about this a few weeks ago. He's one of the opponents of the Rav in writing in the commentator. There were other opponents as well we spoke about. But he becomes very close, his father, and he becomes very close to Rav Soloveitchik. And it's impossible for me to imagine that Mo Feuerstein would ever go around the Rav's back, as it were, or ask a question to another Gadol. His rabbi was Rav Soloveitchik. But at least as the story goes, he was with Rav Aaron Cutler at a wedding, and he asked him, is it permissible for us, the OU, to be together in the synagogue council, these sorts of things? And supposedly Rav Aaron told him no. Now, and this would shortly thereafter lead to the proclamation I'm going to show you. I don't believe the story happened that way, but the Rav Aaron Cutler was definitely asked the question, and others as well, but he was the most significant of the rabbis, the old-time European rabbis in America at the time. And this led to the publication of this document, which Agudas Rabbani, 1956. You see, Kitisa, Yudches Adar, 1956. And well, let me just read it for you. It says as follows: We've been asked from some rabbis in the state, and in people musmachim from yeshivas, if in not in the state, in the country, we've been asked from the different rabbis and musmachim if they could be a member of the New York Board of Rabbis. And other boards, remember, this was very common. Whatever big city you went to, if there was rabbis, they had them on boards together, because these boards are joined together with rabbis and also rabbis. Take a look how rabbi is spelled. This is in the first time I ever saw rabbi spelled this way is in Igros Moshe. Moshe Feinstein, when he wants to talk about non-Orthodox rabbis, he can't call them Rav or Rabbanim. He'll call them Rabbi or Rabbis. And that's how it's written. So with rabbis, reform or conservative. And he says, we've come together, we've discussed this, and it doesn't mean he came together in person necessarily, all of them, but came out from us an Isser, that it's Asr al pi din Torah Sartenu Kedoshah, liyoshchaver, lishtateiv, the irgun kazeh, you can't, according to halacha, you can't, halacha, not just in that wrong thing to do, but it's actually halachic prohibition to join in these organizations. We've also been asked, can you be a member of the Synagogue Council of America? So you might think, well, the rabbis can't because they're giving legitimacy to the rabbis. Well, can the Orthodox organization be together with the non-Orthodox organizations? And the answer is as well that since non-Orthodox organizations are involved, it's usher to be part of them. We're not saying that you can't, it's usher to be part of an organization with non-Orthodox Jews. You can be a member of an organization designed to fight anti-Semitism, which has non-Orthodox Jews. They're not saying that that's a problem. What's a problem is how organizations that you're together at the Synagogue Council of America, where heretical organizations come together. Now, it could be, you can imagine, like a Satmar person saying, Satmar posting, you can't be a member of an organization, any organization, which has non-Orthodox individual Jews. But that was never the argument here. It was not even Hirsch's approach. Individual, we're not, the issue was about organizations. And who signed this letter? Pretty much all, not all, but pretty much all the East European Gedolim who've come to America. Not all after the war, but some before the war, after the war. First is Avram Yaffen, that's Navardic, Avram Kalmanovitz, Meir, Aaron Cutler, of course, Lakewood, he's the leading figure here. Rav Gedalia Shor from Torah Vadas, Rav David Lifshitz, Yeshayahu Rabbi Yochanan, Chaim Mordechai Katz, that's Tells, Yaakov Kamenetsky, also Torah Vadas, Yaakov Yitzhak Halevi Ruderman, Rav Ruderman of Neri Yisrael, Yitzhak Huttner of Chaim Berlin, Menachem Yosef Zaks, in English they sound finesse, but it's pronounced as Zion. He also Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzhak, the son-in-law of the Chafetz Chaim. He was what they call the Bochen, anyone who went to YU in the 50s, or 60s, will remember him. And of course, Moshe Feinstein, the great Posek. Of these, although the case claim is often made that, you know, this is the example here, the beginning of the movement of power from the communal Rav to the Rosh Yeshiva. And it is true. All these people here are Rosh Yeshiva. Not one is a communal Rav. And, that led to a great change. We see it today. When someone has a question, they ask the great Rosh Yeshiva. The Rosh Yeshiva in both the Haredi and in the modern Orthodox world are the ones making all the decisions. Whereas before the war, it was Poskim, and Poskim were always in cities. And generally, Rosh Yeshiva didn't get involved in matters like this because they had to raise money from everyone and they didn't want to offend people. But here you see the beginning and also the move to Das Torah. A lot of people have pointed here you have a declaration that this is usur without, it's not a tshuva, it's not an explanation halachically why it's usur. Like you could ask, why is it usur to be in an organization with the non-Orthodox if we're not dealing with religious matters? We're just dealing with matters of Klal Yisrael, and we know this was done in Germany, and we know this was done in Lithuania and Poland. Although Rav Aharon might say that Lithuania and Poland are just heretical organizations, but they're not actually reformists. But in any event, it certainly could be explained halachically. It's not. It's simply declared like ex cathedra. Now we're used to that today, where you go to Jerusalem, you see all sorts of signs telling you what you can do and what you can't do. But this was like the first time, I think, in America, something like this had made any impact, where they just declare it and you either accept it or you don't, and you accept it by virtue of their charismatic personalities, their halachic standing. I do want to, though, clarify that among these figures, there are some who were communal rabbis. So, for instance, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav David Lifshitz, Rav Kalmanovitz, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Kamenetsky was also a rabbi in Toronto and then in Seattle. So we do have at least former communal rabbis, but at the time, none of them were communal rabbis. Who's missing from it? Before I go on, just say that there is a about this the beginning of Das Torah, let's say. Now, what I'm going to say now is not, this isn't something at all intended by the signatories of this, but this is what it became. Once this sort of document then became popular, and once declarations in a halachic sense were established in this way, it became fashionable in the Haredi world then to judge Rabbanim and Gedolim as to whether they were in line with the Das Torah or not. The reason why, now Ramosha Feinstein himself is not a fan of Das Torah. If you believe Rabbi Tendler said that Ramosha said when they don't have a good argument, I think he said when they don't have a good halach argument, then they fall back on Das Torah. But Das Torah has had a pernicious influence, if I could say that. I know I'll be regarded as heretical in some circles, but it's had a pernicious influence because Das Torah has led to the disqualification of Talmidei Chachamim because they don't toe the whatever the line of Das Torah is. We've reached the place now where you could be a great Talmud Chacham, but if you're not in line with whatever the Haredi Das Torah is, in other words, Das Torah is not a halakhic dispute. Everyone in the Haredi world understands that if you have a halakhic dispute, let's say how hot it has to be for Bishul cooking on Shabbos, one rabbi says 120 degrees, another says 130, whatever it is, no one's going to disqualify the other side because they have a different position, even though according to one rabbi, the other side, his position is Chilul Shabbos, but they understand everyone has different shitas. But with Das Torah and these ex cathedra statements, once you make this Das Torah statement, then the other Rav, who doesn't accept it, doesn't matter what a big a Talmud Chacham is. If Rav Herschel Schechter, if he doesn't accept the Haredi Das Torah, then for certain segments of the Haredi world, he's a Talmud Chacham, but he can't be a Gadol. Because a Gadol has to accept the Das Torah. So you go down the list, therefore, and you can disqualify in the, especially in the extremists, but not just the extremists, mainstream Haredi world, Agudist world, for many of them, you can't be a Gadol unless you hold to the Das Torah. So that's what I say is pernicious because it leads to the disqualification of many Gadol Yisrael and whoever came. This was not something that existed before World War II for the most part. For the most part, certainly not in the Lithuanian world. Hirsch also, I have to say, Hirsch, he disqualified the Mate Levi on that as well. But take a look at Vilna. Vilna, the you know who's on Rav Chaim Moser's based in? The Mar Cheshis, Rav Agus, Chanoch Henoch Agus, and he was Mizrahi. So did anyone ever think, and no one ever said in Vilna to Rav Chaim Moser, how could he be on the Beis Din? He's not a Gadol, because he's not, he's a Zionist. That wasn't how the Lithuanians and the Polish Rabbanim thought. If you were in a town, and you're in Agudistan, and the Rav of the town is a Mizrahi, when you have a Shaila, you ask the Rav. Fine, so then you have a different politics than the Rav. Or if you're a Mizrahi, you ask the Agudist. If he's the Rav of your city, you ask him. Contrast that with today, when many people in that world, if you're a Zionist, then you're Posel. You never ask a Shaila for you. Yeah, you're a Talmud Chacham, but they'll say your hashkafas are krum. Your hashkafas are fraudulent hashkafas, and therefore you can't be a Gadol, and we won't rely on you in terms of psak or anything like that. So that, unfortunately, is the result of what became of this idea of Das Torah and how it's been functioned. But who's missing from this list? First of all, Rav Soloveitchik's name is obviously missing. Rav Eliezer Silver's name is missing. Eliezer Silver is a pulpit rabbi. He's the zaken. He's the elder. He's been in America for a long time. He's in Springfield, Massachusetts, and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Cincinnati. He refused to sign it because he saw this as an anti Yeshivas Chanan document. He said that since most of the students who this is directed against are students of Soloveitchik, why should these Rosh Yeshiva sign it? If they're following Rav Soloveitchik, what's the point of such a declaration? Now, what happened was the Rosh Yeshiva wanted Rav Soloveitchik to sign it. He didn't. But from Rav Eliezer Silver's point, once Rav Soloveitchik refused to sign, it shouldn't have been publicized. Now, Rav Lichtenstein writes that Rav Reuven Grozovsky, also from firmly in the Haredi world, also refused to sign because he had the same attitude as Rav Eliezer Silver, that these students from Yeshivas Rabbeinu Elchanan, and they were the majority, but not the only ones. You had students from other yeshivas as well who were members of these organizations, but most were from Yeshivas Rabbeinu Elchanan and, let's say, Skokie, or those days Chicago. The Rav Reuven Grozovsky also refused to sign because he says if they're following their Rebbe, why should we interfere? Now, two people when I mentioned this last time, two people, both learned, very learned in American Orthodox history, said it doesn't make sense because in 1956, Ruhringer-Zavsky was very ill, and it doesn't make sense that he would at all be involved in the public square. I don't know how ill he was. Was he in a coma? Was he, you couldn't talk to him? I mean, if he's in bed and he couldn't move, wasn't active, that doesn't mean he still can't sign the document. Rav Lichtenstein was living at that time. It's hard to imagine that he'd say something like that isn't false. Not to mention, in fact, he now is, it's Rav Lichtenstein then became part of the family of Ruhringer-Zavsky with his son's, Yitzhak's marriage. So I don't know, but Rav Lichtenstein says Rav Ruhringer-Zavsky had the same perspective. Now, Rav Moshe is said to have commented that usually we say that silence is acquiescence. Shtika kodah danya. The Rav didn't sign, so he agrees. But the Rav Moshe said not in this case, and that's true. And we spoke about in the classes on the Rav's letters that the Rav refused to sign. He didn't from, and this has been confirmed by a number of people, although he didn't support these organizations like the boards of rabbis. He never offered it, and he didn't think they were good ideas, but if people wanted to do it, he didn't say it was forbidden. He thought that the Synagogue Council of America was important for the Orthodox to be part of. Walter Wurzburger writes that although the Rav, in theory, would have preferred that there never was such an organization, once it came into existence, he thought it was vital for the Orthodox to be a part of it, because you can't leave, as we saw when we discussed the Rav, you can't leave the public square to the non-Orthodox. If you're going to have an organization of Jews, of communal organizations, synagogues, the Orthodox have to be involved. The rabbis, you know, at the end of the day, how much do the boards of rabbis do? But the other organizations, it's very important that the OU be part of it. And the Rav's position follows the view of the Nitziv. The Nitziv, now Talit Sudha Berlin, right? There was this group in Galicia called the Machzikei Das. And they were, I guess, enamored by what they saw in Hungary and what they saw in Germany, and they wanted to form an organization also in Poland that you know, separatism, to fight for separatism, so that the Orthodox can create their own communities, so they're not in the same communities with the Bundists and the revisionists and the Zionists and all that. And that's when we see wrote it, wasn't yet dealing with revisionists, but you know, non-Orthodox types. The Nitziv has a famous tshuva in which he says that we cannot agree with this. He says that this idea of separatism is like daggers in our heart. He says that when we deal with the non-Jewish world, we need to deal with it together as a unit, then as one people. And then we come back and we fight among ourselves about all the various issues. But when we face the non-Orthodox, we have to face them together. And if you recall, I read this when I did the classes on the Rav. The Rav said, in the crematoria, the ashes of the pious and those filled with praiseworthy deeds mingled with the ashes of the radicals and free thinkers. He says, we jointly fight the enemy who doesn't recognize the difference of the religious and the non-religious. And that's, so the Rav is following in the path of the Nitziv, and really, what was the path in Lithuania? You could say, and many have said, that it's the other Rosh Yeshiva that broke with this. I'm not so sure they broke with it, because again, you could make a distinction. I'm not sure one way or the other. You could say that the Nitziv and others are speaking about irreligious Jews, but they're not speaking about reform and conservative. That is, they're speaking about irreligious Jews who simply don't want anything to do with religion. So we can be in one community with them, because at the end of the day, there's no issues with the synagogue. They leave religion to us because they don't care about religion. But when you deal with the reform and conservative, then you're dealing with people who are twisting the Torah. They're not rejecting the Torah. They're twisting it and creating falsehood, and that they're more dangerous. And that's a different circumstance, and they actually have synagogues. I'm not sure whether there's a difference. I can see both sides of this, because at the end of the day, what if you're dealing with some Zionist, let's say, who's an atheist? I mean, isn't that also proud to be one community? Because you have to vote, decide who's going to be the rabbi, and he's going to prefer, let's say, fine, every rabbi is going to be Orthodox, but he's going to prefer a Zionist rabbi, and he's going to prefer. Why should he have a say at all? in choosing the rabbi. Well, you could say, well, he's a member of the community, just he's not religious. The rabbi has to minister to him too. But I could see how you could claim that if certainly if you could be with these atheists and these complete secularists, you can be with people who observe some mitzvos. But that's the argument. I'll just end with America. I just want to read you a tshuva. You know what? I'll do this next time. I want to read you a tshuva of Rav Moshe. Because Rav Moshe Feinstein has a short tshuva on this, where he does express his opinion. And I'm not sure how far to take this if you want to follow Rav Moshe. But I think Rav Moshe expresses the standard view from that circle. I'll add one more thing. I heard this from Rabbi Lookstein. So Rabbi Lookstein, Haskell Lookstein, who followed in his father's footsteps, he was in the New York Board of Rabbis. He might have been the president, very involved with this. So he said as follows. I didn't hear it from him personally. He came to Scranton to speak. He was brought in by the Scranton community, not by me. He was speaking about, I guess what's it's very interesting, Scranton, because a lot of the old timers, this is probably around 2000, but a lot of the old timers, the non-Orthodox Jews in Scranton complain about the Orthodox today because they always speak about how Rav Gutterman was very different. And in those days, the Orthodox rabbi was, they look back to the old days, the good old days, when they thought things were different. So they brought in Rabbi Lookstein and he gave, a rousing talk. There were very few of the Orthodox there. I can tell you that. It was all the rest of the community. Unfortunately, all these people who were at the talk have since passed on. So he spoke about his vision of orthodoxy. And then he told the following story. He said that after Rav Moshe passed away, he went to be Menachem Avo, the children. And when he was there, as he first, I think he's the way he described it as when he first came in, or it might have been before he even went to it, whatever it is. I think it was when he arrived there. Someone came up to him. You can ask Rabbi Lookstein, confirm it, and said to him, "Right, you have a lot of chutzpah coming here to be Menachem Avo. You know that Rav Moshe spoke again and again against, New York Board of Rabbis, and you refused to listen to Rav Moshe, and you joined it, and now you're going to come be Menachem Avo." So the person was saying that, you spit in Rav Moshe's face, and now you're going to come. And Lookstein ignored him and went, and he was, and the children were received him very well and very happy to. And Reb Lookstein's point was, yes, I followed my Rebbe, but it didn't mean that I didn't have great respect for Reb Moshe and I didn't see him as the great posek. And the children, he said, could understand that I had a different position. It doesn't mean that there's something wrong with me going there. So I thought that's interesting. Let me get to the questions and the comments here quickly. Also, next class, I'll just finish up with Rav Moshe, and then I want to turn to Rav Kook. I don't think I'll take the whole class Rav Kook because Rav Bamberger becomes important for Rav Kook. And then hopefully we'll move into maybe next class, if not next class, definitely the class after, back to Rav Bamberger. I want to fill you in on some interesting shittas he had and some other things. Ben says, how assimilated the Orthodox were, or how integrated. Okay, I said showed how assimilated they were. Assimilated, integrated, it depends how, who's talking. Obviously, if you're a Hungarian Jew or a Polish Jew from one of the Ostjuden, they're called, and you come to Germany, you look at these German Orthodox Jews named Adolf and, Josef and all these names, and going to the opera and everything, you see that as assimilation, not as integration. From the German Orthodox perspective, it's integration. Assimilation, we assume assimilation means assimilation then leading to losing your identity, intermarriage, all that. Maybe the word assimilation can also be used. You assimilate to the larger community. It doesn't mean you lose all your identity. The German Orthodox Jews were German patriots. They were very attached to Germany, and Germany is a Christian country. It's not like America. I mean, it was a Christian country. Look at some of the literature around World War I. How attached they felt, and that what they were fighting for the Kaiser. So I guess we can debate, is integration or assimilation the best word? Paul says rabbinic names. The late chief rabbi of South Africa, Rabbi Cyril Harris, Cyril K. Harris. K stood for Kitchener. This I did not know. I know Rabbi Harris's son, Rabbi Michael Harris. Those who don't know, he wrote a very nice book about Orthodox ideology in modern times. I forget what it's called. It's like a Moreh Nevuchim of sorts. And then he, together with Professor Reinhold of Yeshiva University, published a very good book on Rav Soloveitchik and Nietzsche. And So that's Kitchener. I did not know that poll. Anything English, I've learned that Paul is the expert on, especially all this arcane English stuff. So shkoyach for that. Yenisson says, Rav Tovia directed you to pronounce the second sin of Yisachar's birth. That's a minhag. There's a few minhagim. In fact, as Michael reminds me, if you look, the names of Yisachar's children, one of his sons, one of the names, it has a shin, and when it's repeated a second time, it's missing the shin. And so they say, well, that shows that one place you take it out, one you don't. There's different minhagim. And some say that, in fact, if you look in the Hirsch's transliterated Chumash, not transliterated, in his German Chumash, the names, up until in Bereishis, he writes it Yisachar. And later, in other places, it's Yisachar. So there's a whole tradition that you're supposed to read it the first time, or maybe not just the first time. You said this, maybe it's the second sin. I mean, the first
It's
time.
the first time at his birth. That's what I mean. The
Yeah,
first.
only at his birth, right? Only at his birth. But I think there might be minhagim that others do it. Hold on. Rabbi Boich, actually, in Contemporary Halachic Problems, Volume 1, he has an article. He just summarizes it. This is from when he used to actually have a column. And he says the accepted practice is to vocalize the name Yisachar always. However, there is a practice. He quotes the Chosam Sofer, who says that, yes, that the first instance of the word, you recite it, Yisachar. So that, and there may, it doesn't begin with the Chosam Sofer. This is a tradition. But you said the Mincha Shai. The Mincha Shai doesn't say it.
Yeah, I
Liz
think
Shane, and
you suggested Mincha Shai last week, or I thank you for correcting me.
oh, I thought you said, I said I wasn't sure. I said it definitely wasn't. I said the medievals. Ruth says one last known name, Yisachar. In the Korah and Das Mikra Tanakhs, there is no nikud on or under the second shin. It would seem that the Masoretes did not pronounce the second shin at all. That's correct. There's no nikud on it at all. It's a silent letter. There's another silent letter in Asadi in Divrei Yomim, on one of the words. But yes, that's it's unusual. The question is, why didn't they just drop it? You have a negation, the sin. For whatever reason, it wasn't dropped. That's Ben Asher. That's what we follow. However, Ben Naphtali, it wouldn't have been, and you would have had a nikud on the second shin.
Right, but the reason there's two letters there is because of the way she named him, Yesh Sachar. That's
That would imply the pshat that it should, that's what Ben Naphtali should be read as Yish Sachar.
yeah, but you can't do that. So they just made it silent.
Okay, so then it's so that you're right. So that, but then why would there be the second sin? I was
Because it's
thinking
still
that the
there.
whole thing was combined.
It's not a sin or a shin. It's nothing. It has
But
no
why is it? But
problem.
presumably it was. I assume that it was two sins, or a shin and a sin and a chop. You're saying it's not. Why would it be there though?
No,
It's.
there's no dot. There's no dot
I
on
know,
the.
but why do you have the letter? That's the question. The
Just
first, the dagesh is because the shin drops. Why is there a second sin?
to preserve the derivation of the name. Yesh Sachar is why she called him that. And so the name is, so you spell it, and that's a remembrance. It's a zecher of why she called him that.
Okay, that's interesting. Of course, it would be better if the then you'd have it on the second sin that you'd have it, that the first shin was silent with no nekudot, and then the second. That would be better. But okay, I like what you said though.
A Sephardi taxi driver once corrected my Yisachar to Yisachar.
No, he's Sephardi. He's roughly wrong on that if he's Sephardi. If he told me he's a Hasidic guy, then they
No.
would say it. Hadassah says the Great Synagogue of Warsaw is not Orthodox. Okay, when you say not Orthodox, we have to understand what you mean by non-Orthodox. It had men and women did not sit together. There's no organ. It's no different than any of our modern Orthodox synagogues today. There's a choir, something like that. You'd walk into it, you'd think the choral synagogue, in Moscow, or the synagogue in Vilna, you would think that they are Orthodox. They were regarded as liberal synagogues, and sometimes they could even hire a rabbi who would not have been regarded as Orthodox, but they functioned in an Orthodox fashion. You had in Lemberg, Lvov, if you recall, remember the rabbi, the Reform rabbi, who was poisoned? But his shul functioned. So what do you do when the shul functions Orthodox, but the rabbi's not Orthodox? I guess it's not Orthodox. But I don't know in Warsaw if that would be regarded as non-Orthodox. I don't know if any of the rabbis there, I think the rabbis were all considered Orthodox, unlike the one in Lemberg. I think they were all considered liberal Orthodox, status quo or German Orthodox types, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think that in the Great Synagogue, all the rabbis were Orthodox. Nissan says, Dr. Isaac Breuer, leader of Aguda in Germany, led Pole Aguda in Eretz Yisrael, even when Pole officially broke with Aguda over the issue of cooperation. I don't remember all the details. I have the book, The History of Pole Aguda Yisrael, but Pole, I mean, Aguda themselves would break. Pole and Aguda, in 1948, Pole and Aguda were together. There was all this tension. But in 1948, they worked together.
They ran together. But Poale rejected Moetzes authority in political matters over the issue in cooperation with Yishuv authorities. That was in 1940. I know this from high leaders in Israel. I was told this.
I think they came back together, and it wasn't until later in the early 1950s when they officially broke with them. Yeah.
I learned it. It broke my ears to hear this, but that's what
I think in 1948 they still regarded the Moetzes Gedolei Torah as binding them.
Not in political matters, really. And that was the and then Rav Shach, of course, came in, when he was the one who said you can't vote for Dalit anymore. After vote
yeah,
for
but I'm saying with Kalman Kahana, they broke and the Chazon Ish came out. This is already in the early 50s. They officially went again. Okay, I didn't know. I know there's big machokas, and I have the book by Chaim Shalim on the history of Pole Aguda.
Every election, they will come together and they separate. Every election, they did it in the 50s.
Yeah, they come together, but the difference is that once they broke, they went against the Chazon Ish, then they were considered Mechutz HaMachaneh, and that then led to them really becoming more Tzioni, I guess you could say. Paul says Aguda in Palestine was founded by Moshe Blau, had no roots in Europe. And the nadir of their behavior was the lynching of an effigy of Cook One Purim. The Aguda was publicly represented to the mandate by the cult of the figure of Dahan. Yes, we've spoken about all these matters before. The Aguda Sistral ties themselves, though, to Ramosha Blau. And by the way, Ramosha Blau remains loyal to the Aguda, even though his brother is the extremist Ramram boy. If you recall the classes, Ramosha Blau dies in Chutzaretz, and Rasiuda Cook declares that that's his onesh for causing my father's early death, that the land spit him out. I even showed you the picture, a new picture that was uncovered a few years ago of them loading his body into the boat. But and we spoke in the past also about the trial, the Tzir HaGudas Yisrael, how they put Rav Kook on trial, and then they actually they executed him. That's the effigy you're speaking about. They executed Rav Kook, his effigy. They shot him. They made believe they shot him. Well, I went through that whole issue that was in Batei Broid in Jerusalem. This was on Meltzer, how he then refused to have any part of it. That's the sort of thing I'm speaking about. And yes, the Aguda was represented by Dahan, the first of the great anti-Zionists. If Dahan was around today, he'd be marching with Hamas and all the rest of it. Enough about Dahan. Let's see. I said, if Moses first, I said Morris first. If I said Morris, I meant Moses. Yeah, Mo. I said once, he sat right next to me in Young Israel, Brookline, because I moved to Brookline in 1993, and I go to the Young Israel. I don't know where to sit, and he's sitting like in the front row, and he doesn't know who I am, but he sees me. He says, "Here, come sit here." Because, people don't like sit in the front. So the time I was at the Young Israel Brookline, I sat in the front row next to him and his son. And Nissen says that Dvar Avraham was a Mizrachist. He was elected as a Dayan in Kovno. Dvar Avraham was not a Dayan. He was the Rav of Kovno. He was also the official Rav of Kovno. And he was not an official Mizrachis. He never was a member, but he believed in the ideology. And he was an opponent of Aguda. We even have a letter he wrote to Rav Kook, in which he talks about how very negative about the Aguda. And look, the yeshiva world didn't care for the Dvar Avraham. And in fact, Jeffrey Wolf told a story, I don't know who he heard it from. The Dvar Avraham, he once supported this organization, this in Kovno, the boys and girls coming together, some joint organization where young men and women come together, and the yeshiva students attacked him, and he said, I'm not the Rav for the yeshiva students, I'm the Rav for the entire community, and this is what we need to do. You know, he was very much a modern type of forward-thinking individual, and a great, great posek. If you read the book of Rav Ashri's Tshuvos, you learn a lot about him. And unfortunately, he was able to leave. He could have gone out of made his way to Switzerland, but he didn't. And he died. But he died. He had a kavuras yisrael. He was not killed. He died in the Kovno ghetto. Mem J. Franco says Rav Henkin lived in the '70s and isn't there. Haven't heard why. Look, Rav Henkin was head of Ezra's Torah. He had to raise money from everyone. And he had to raise money from all the rabbis. He never, as a matter of principle, would sign any declaration like this. And not because he didn't have feelings. He says he has a responsibility. His job is to raise money for Torah. And he can't do anything that is going to turn someone off and not give money. Look, if he would have signed it, could he go to Lichtenstein Shul then and try to raise money? So, but I don't know. Unfortunately, his grandson's not alive. I don't know Rav Henkin's feeling. Rav Henkin might have personally agreed that there's nothing wrong with these organizations. But no matter what he felt, he couldn't sign it. And the yeshivas, pre-war in Europe, the yeshivas, Rosh Yeshiva would never sign. Rav Chanan Wasserman is an exception. But the Rosh Yeshiva of Sobotka tells Mir they never would sign any declaration, any political declaration, because they needed to raise money from everyone. It makes sense. Okay, Paul says senior moment was Alan being very at Jerusalem, but Kitchener, so I don't, why would he call him Kitchener? Okay, Bina says on the declaration of the state, the Aguda and PA signed independently. Is there a member of Pole Agudas Yisrael who signed the declaration of independence?
Yes, Kahana signed it. He told me himself, and I say it's there. He was in America at the time.
I know they're always separate organizations. My only issue is I thought that in 1948 they still declared fealty to the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, and they would break that a few years later.
I met with a child.
Yeah.
He spoke about it once at a Shalashudas in our Shtibel, the Poale Aguda, and he spoke about how it was. I remember this from my childhood. I was a young child, but I spoke to him later as an adult. It was something that was, it was with deliberation. He is in the classical picture, in that the long table facing Ben Gurion when he has, what was the name of the Mizrahi leader, the great. On Ben Gurion's right side, I think.
Maimon.
Fisher Maimon. Right. So there's a long table facing, perpendicular to them, I should say. And there's a very tall young man with a dark beard sitting immediately adjacent to that main table. That is Rav Kalman Kahana.
That's not the issue. The issue I'm concerned with is Poale Agudas Yisrael officially breaks with Aguda's Moetzes Gedolei Torah, and they appoint their own Rabboni, Meir Karelitz, from the Chazon Ish's brother. But as far as I know, in 1948, despite any issues they had earlier, they still said that they accept the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, although they represent the Poalim, the workers, etc. But at the end of the day, they will listen to whatever Moetzes Gedolei Torah says. I am certain that that was their position until early 50s when they would break with them and join the government. That's my recollection.
Agreed.
That's my certainty. Gershon says he wonders where the Yisachar dilemma is the origin of the phrase kicking someone you don't like it in the shin. Okay. Listen, if it's funny because if you read the Rishonim, there's no nekudos. So how do they tell you if it's a shin or a sin? So it's not so simple. So sometimes, you know, they'll say things like they'll use the word sin, the right sin, you know, as a shin, so you know what they're talking about. I'll read you. Hold on. Let me read you like just the lashon. I think it's even in the. And this is the last thing we'll say. I think it's even in here. The
maybe they're from Shevet Ephraim.
Hold on. So if you read, hold on. Just a second. No, it's not here. But it's hard to know what they're speaking about sometimes. So they'll say. Sometimes they'll use the word sin. I don't know if they're Rishonim, but the Masoretes will either say sin or they'll say. You know, they'll say right, yamin, or small, or what to do. What'd you say, Chaim?
Maybe that's from Shevet Ephraim in the times of the Tanakh that were not able to say sin.
Yeah, I don't, but, I mean, look, I don't know, we know that the Rishonim could because they distinguish it. Lita, then it goes back. We know that there are certain Lithuanian rabbis who couldn't say shin. They couldn't say Shabbos, good Shabbos, it'll give you a good Sabbos. But, as far as I know, we don't have any references to, in the Rishonim or the Masoretes that, there's no distinction. They do distinguish it. They say there's a distinction. So, I don't know. Listen, we know that in Rishonim that, some of them didn't distinguish Patach and Kamat. So we see that. And we know that the other letters sounded the same. But as far as I know, Shin and Sin, we don't have that. There's a Professor Steiner, right? From YU. He wrote a book, something like, what's the title of it? Richard Steiner, The Case for the Fricative Shin or something like that. Some title that's really going to grab you in the bestseller list. But he's like the world's expert on the Shin and the Sin, Professor Steiner. I think Rabbi Kelman, this says, okay, I think we are, we're done. We're okay. Finished. Thank you all for coming out. Final comments, Rabbi Kelman.
No comments, just, you know, listening into all the conversation. Okay, I mean, tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman and Shir Shirma might be mentioning the last two classes. Wednesday, Rabbi Brody, Shlomo Brody, who's spoken a few times, will start a new series on military ethics that's based on, I assume, based on the book he just published that just came out now.
It's definitely going to be based on the book, and everyone, I'm sure, it's so in Yonah Dioma.
Yes, unfortunately. I mean, he wrote the book, obviously, before October 7th, but it just got published within the last month, I believe. So we'll be giving three-part series, and we have all our regular classes. Of course, today we had the lost synagogue classes. I mentioned a lot of you were there this afternoon. And, of course, Shuli Mishkin, part two of her new series on the Gates of Gaza. That's Wednesday. So they'll be Wednesday back-to-back. Rabbi Nachbar is giving the Parshat HaShavuah here this week. And I think that's pretty much it. And we should hear good news and good things, and everybody should be well. And like I've been saying, it's the winter. It's 2024. It's early. Everybody has homework to invite one friend, one new friend to attend one class. And, you know, then they'll invite a friend, and they'll invite a friend. And then chevra the chevra itle, as we say. So everybody, if you could do that, we'd be most appreciative. Word of mouth is the best form of advertising. Okay, everybody. Lila to Paul, if you wanted to say something, I know from before, or you're fine. Okay, just checking. As Mark said, you're the expert on English, you know, Jewry, and I believe your master's is on the old Yeshiva. Is that correct? Your master's theories thesis was on the old Yeshiva of Yerushalayim. And okay, I know he's my former boss. So when he was in the years in Toronto at Tenenbaum Chat, if I can say that, I hope he doesn't mind. Head of school for many years in Chat. And okay, anyways, everybody be well. Laila Tov, and all the best, everybody. Thank you.